Hi, everybody. It's Ray again with Plundergrounds. We've got some call-ins today that has inspired a number of thoughts about all kinds of stuff. We're going to talk about magical forests. We're going to talk about hermeneutics and linguistics and extensibility and closed versus open systems. And we're going to finish off with a discussion of combat using rules light or more narrative systems and how to do that or how I would do that. So let's get started with a call in from Carl about Rush.
A very interesting thing about Rush to me is how, why everyone lauds over Neil Peart as the professor of the drum kit, one of the best drummers ever. Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee are great musicians, but not as well given, are not given as much acclaim for their musicianship. For, you know, Geddy Lee's bass lines or Alex Lifeson's ability to shred, right? If you listen to 2112, I mean, that's an amazing guitar solo in there. And he has many, many more. And Geddy Lee, I mean, I think Geddy Lee, one of the best examples of his musicianship is YYZ and just that amazing jazzy bass riffs that he comes up with. So they're all great musicians, and Neil Peart, rest in peace, my friend. Back in the day, I was able to see Rush live, so I saw them for both the Moving Pictures tour. That was one of my first shows, and then Signals, which I had great mezzanine seats for. Got to sit like in the middle of the arena. I think they played in like the old San Antonio Arena both times, and man, that was an amazing show. You know, one of the first uses that I saw was that sort of that laser light show that they used to have back in the 80s. Memorable, very memorable. Subdivisions is still one of my favorite songs that they play, so it's just a very poignant song to me as a nerd and in that Subdivision type culture growing up, you know. I guess a sad thing for me is that the last album I really know is Distant Early Warning, and I know they've had a host of albums after, and I really need to get back into that catalog, the more recent, quote unquote recent catalog, because Distant Early Warning was a while ago, right? But I mean, I know I have like Clockwork Angels, for example, and others here and there, but I really need to dig into that catalog. I would say my favorite album might be Exit Stage Left, although that's not really a real album, right? Studio albums we're talking about. I don't know, man. I gotta say, I mean, although Hemispheres was the first album I bought with my own money, probably 2112 is probably my favorite album. I mean, I do like the earlier stuff, but then, you know, I'm more metal than prog rock, so there you go.
Thank you for that call in, Carl. Yeah, Rush is, well, Rush is, period. They're an endless fascination for me, and I think many others. I started with either 2112 or Hemispheres. I had both of those on vinyl. I remember both very clearly and listening to them over and over and over and over. They had that really cool artistic dreamlike quality to them. And I kind of quit at Distant Early Warning. Not because I stopped liking Rush, but I think because at that time I got into punk and really early blues and some other musical styles that kind of drew me away from Rush for a while. And I never quite got into their newer albums. But like you say, there's probably a lot there to discover that I could go back to. Having said that, I'm perfectly happy going back and listening to all the old albums of theirs that I've listened to before and getting new things out of them. And it made me think about, just thinking about Rush kind of sent me down a whole rabbit hole of thoughts about rediscovering familiar works and hermeneutics and extensibility and some different ideas. So I'm going to kind of tackle that a little bit. It may be a little rambly because it's kind of a dreamlike thought in it of itself. Kind of a driving thought, if you will, the kind of thoughts you have while driving where one thing just leads to another into a long chain. And I started off thinking about the Rush song Rivendell, oddly enough. And then that made me think about the Rush song The Trees, which comes from Hemispheres, which you may recall the lyrics are just really stick in your head. You know, there's unrest in the forest. There's trouble with the trees. And it's kind of a war among the trees. And so I was thinking about magical forests and specifically Lothlorien, which is kind of a place out of time, if you will. And how, when I read The Lord of the Rings as a young man, Lothlorien just seemed like a kind of heaven or nirvana that, our characters, the Fellowship minus Gandalf at that point, were allowed to stop in for a while for respite to heal and dress their wounds and both, you know, mental and emotional wounds as well as physical ones, and to gather their breath before the final push. And it just seemed like an idyllic setting. But rereading it as an adult, or just later, I'll say, I don't know that I wasn't an adult before. I can't remember. I mean, I've read it multiple times in my life, but rereading it over the last couple times, I find Lothlorien terrifying. And I think Steve Jackson with the movies, this is one thing he did fairly well, is made Lothlorien as slightly frightening as well as beautiful and eerie and you know, providing solace and comfort. It also provides mystery and disturbing, just disturbances, right? Like psychic disturbances. Well, Lothlorien means dream flower. That's its sort of interpretation in Tolkien's linguistic tradition there. And I think what people don't really always realize about it is this idea of stasis. And if you grew up in the Protestant or Catholic tradition and of Christianity, your ideas of heaven, at least I'll say Protestant. I don't have experience with Catholic, really. So I'll just speak to my own experience. I grew up in the Protestant church, Bible Belt America. Many, many things terrifying about that that I can go into on another day, maybe, probably not. But one of the things that I always thought was terrifying was the vision of heaven. And it was just this idea of God at the center of this very cold reality that has formulated out of minerals, right? You see the pearly gates and streets of gold. And so all these cold materials, and around the throne were just people singing God's praises all day long. No independent thought, just kind of echoing back God's greatness to him. And I thought, wow, that's just, you know, well, that's supposed to sound awesome. To me, it sounded terrifying. Like I'm going to lose all sense of individual thought or creativity. I'm going to dwell in a place that seems unnatural, you know, has no nature in it. So there's just lots of stuff there to unpack. But I think Lothlorien is fascinating because while it preserves a type of beauty and rest and safety, it preserves it at the expense of being something that flows with time. It's static. It has no touch with reality. It is itself kind of apart from reality. But in the end, it'll be judged by reality. So like after the war, after the fall of Sauron, apparently everybody leaves Lothlorien, including Celebrimbor or whoever it is. And that's not right, is it? Because Galadriel and her consort there, I can't think of his name, but he goes to Rivendell apparently, which is another place out of town. So out of time, out of town. It's certainly out of town, but it's also out of time. So I don't know. I was thinking about that, and it reminded me of the way hermeneutics was explained to me as a young man. Somebody drew a spiral on a chalkboard and they put a text at the center of the spiral. Now we're actually going back to church again. This is another Bible thing, but hermeneutics isn't necessarily related to the Bible. It could be any text at the center of that. But you have this kind of spiral, and if you draw a ray out from that center point, you'll intersect the spiral, you know, at different places. But basically, you can think of each round of the spiral as a year of your life. Every year of your life, you gain experiences and you go places and you change contexts and new things happen to you and your body chemistry changes and all that kind of stuff. And because of that, when you return to the text, each time your understanding grows and or changes. It becomes different, right? So there's a Greek philosopher, Heraclitus, who is referred to as the Dark One. If we're going to circle this back, makes him sound like Sauron. Heraclitus, the Dark One, they called him the Dark One because he was so hard to understand. Like he's a little bit unfathomable. His ideas were dark, if you will. But he has a famous saying, no man can ever step in the same river twice because it won't be the same river and he won't be the same man. And it's what I'm talking about here, essentially, which is, I suppose the colloquial American way of saying that is you can't go home again, right? I grew up in small town America, but if I go back there, it's not the small town America that I remember. It's completely different. In fact, it's gone through multiple kind of iterations or stages since I was a kid. And even if it were exactly the same, I couldn't experience it the same way because I am a different person. It would feel different to me. So I think that's, what did I want to say ultimately about that? How does that relate to role-playing? I don't know that it does. I mean, it does in all kinds of ways, but nothing specific. Like every time you read a role-playing game text, you discover something new. Every time you play the game, you discover something new. But I think it kind of, like I said, it was a driving thought. It also spiraled me into this idea of extensibility. So Noam Chomsky, who's kind of the founder of modern formal linguistics, in the 1950s wrote a book called Syntactic Structures. I think that's right. And he said that the interesting thing about language is its extensibility. And what he means by that is having been exposed to a small part of it, human beings seem to be able to imagine, to extrapolate, to conjecture all the possible forms of it. So even though you're given a handful of words and a little bit of structure, you can make up sentences forever, essentially. And that makes me think of role-playing games, right? That's what role-playing games are like. Been reading The Elusive Shift with JJ and Bill. And as always, the book isn't nearly as good as the conversations that we have about the book, which is in itself a form of hermeneutics, if you will, because we're adding to each other's understandings and growing as we read it. But there was this comment in there, and I can't remember, was it Gygax? But somebody was talking about closed versus open systems. And it made me think that, like, we were talking about different litmus tests. JJ and Bill and I were talking about different litmus tests that you could apply to role-playing games to decide whether it's a role-playing game or not. Because the book is, The Elusive Shift is a lot about what does role-playing mean, the term, or how did it grow over time? And, you know, we kind of, it's not going to answer that question with finality, of course, because it can't really be answered. A lot of the discussions that we have today are the same discussions that were there in the outset of the hobby, in the first 3 to 4 years of the hobby, or at least the first 3 to 4 years after the publication of original D&D, however you want to date the hobby is up to you. But what was I going to say? So closed versus open systems is the idea. A closed system is something where everything possible is sort of defined. A board game is a closed system. You know, Monopoly, everything you do in Monopoly is governed by the rules, and every rule is in play at all times. And it's its own closed environment, its own little world. You can't go off board, if you will. You can't just make up stuff. You can't teleport to the, well, you can, but then you're no longer playing Monopoly, right? If you invent the teleporter and add it to Monopoly or whatever. Well, role-playing games are open systems. And I like what Peterson, the author of The Elusive Shift, has to say more about it in his earlier work, Playing at the World. And apparently he's got a third book coming out soon. So it's mostly rehashing the same research different ways, I think. But that one's going to be about the history of TSR up to the ejection of Gary Gygax. Well, he says about role-playing games and playing at the world that they are games in which you can try anything. And that to me is sort of the magic bullet right there. It's a game in which the rules are necessarily insufficient. They're necessarily limited. You can only describe a certain number of situations, and you extrapolate or conjecture the rest. It's an extensible system. If we go back to Chomsky's theory of languages, linguistics, and apply that to what's cool about role-playing games is you can have a very small amount of rules and you can extend them infinitely, right? To different worlds, to different actions, to different mindsets. Yeah. So I just think that's really cool. That was my morning drive in a nutshell. If you want to know what it's like to be with me in the car, it's either that or me loudly singing some horrible bit of trucker music or something just to kind of be silly. So I'm not always that deep in my morning drives, but there you go. And next we have another call in from Dennis, first time caller. Oh, quickly, before we get to Dennis, I guess I should have mentioned that part of this thinking probably was inspired by my recent trip up north to Northern California, where I visited a grove of sequoias and, of course, stood in awe at the scale of these massive trees, which also got me thinking a little bit about Lothlorien, you know, magical forests. But also change and, you know, the impermanence of things, because these groves are in danger from a variety of, like, they need fire to really germinate. So if the forest doesn't burn down every so often, the sequoias don't really thrive the way they should, which is an odd naturalistic oxymoronic kind of concept, right? You got to burn it down to grow. But also there's only like something like 68 groves of these trees. They only come in groves. I think as small as like 5 or 6 trees, but they only seem to grow in, you know, in companionship, if that makes sense, naturally. And, and you have to kind of like travel into the forest to find them. They're mostly in preserves, right? So I don't know, this is kind of another echo of the same ideas in reality. And maybe I'll put up a picture. I used the panoramic feature on my camera in a vertical way. If you've never done that, it's really cool. Like if you're looking at a really tall building, you just turn your camera. If you have an iPhone that does panoramic or whatever that does panoramic pictures, turn it on its side, start at the bottom and travel up instead of traveling sideways, right? And you get this odd like fisheye perspective of a thing. So I may, if I can find a way to stick the images into this podcast or link them through, I'll send you some, I'll let you look at some pictures of these amazing sequoias. And it was a pretty awesome experience. And okay, without further ado, here's Dennis.
Hey Ray, it's Dennis calling in from the Netherlands. I don't know if you could call me a long-time listener. I am a first-time caller though. The reason I haven't called into your podcast before is that I just discovered it in the beginning of this year, I think. And going through your back catalog ever since, and obviously seeing that you had stopped putting out issues at the end of December last year or so, really sad about that. But then before I could reach that episode, you picked it up again, which made me really excited. And I'm also really excited that you're not limiting yourself to the reviews. I do like those, but I also like your rambly train of thought episodes a lot, like a lot. I'm going to turn this into 2 parts because, you know, the numbers are going red on the Anchor app. Part 2, because I do have a question for you. A little bit of background. I discovered your podcast through your Oracle, which I discovered through a podcast called Subclass Act by Jim Shraw. I believe I pronounced that right. And because of your podcast, I really got into Rules Light or Light Rules. Let's not get into that discussion again. Systems. And I would like to run something like Lasers and Feelings or your own Sorcerers and Cell Swords. And I was wondering how you would handle combat in a system like that, because it doesn't really provide rules for that, I think. And I think you could do something with opposed checks, like maybe in a system like Just Halberds by Alex Schroeder. Just wondering how you would do combat that would require more than like 1 dice roll. Thanks a lot for the podcast. Keep it up.
What an awesome call, Dennis. Thank you so much for going through my back catalog. I think there's some real ups and downs in there. So there's some episodes I'm real proud of that I still really enjoy. And there's some other rambling messes that you'll discover, but hopefully you'll get something out of everything there. And I agree. I think that while I love I think there's a lot of good work done with the reviews. I also like doing these more rambling podcasts and just being more natural, I guess. So, and I appreciate your listening to all of it. And I'm so happy that you found it right when you won't have to experience a long break. So great question. I think this is something that maybe confound a lot of people when they look at these rules light systems. I kind of prefer to think about it as almost an unlearning. So because we've learned how to do combat with hit points, it's harder to imagine doing fight scenes or just the idea of damage. It's not necessarily just physical fighting, but the idea of the sort of spiral down of a character. What does it mean to, for a character to be defeated, to be stopped, to stop functioning without the ideas of hit points and damage? And I will say that there's kind of a spectrum here. There's the full fiction on one side of things, and on the other side of things, there's an abstract, like a quantitative hit point number. So we're going to start at one end and work our way to the other, and we're going to start at the fictional end of things. So when you're running kind of a more freeform game or a rules light game, and you get into conflict, it could be it could be a psychic battle that's doing damage to people's minds, or it could be a battle for your sanity. But, you know, most often I think in our adventure games, it's going to be physical, right? You're going to run in to a bunch of mangy goblins that want to steal your stuff, and you're going to pull out your slingshot or your sword or whatever and go to it. And without hit points, how does that look? What does that look like? Well, it fundamentally looks like anything else. It is, I would say that systems that have robust combat mechanics often do that in a way that differentiates those mechanics from the way everything else in the game is handled. Now, sometimes they bring it back. Like D&D started out with having almost no mechanics around non-combat sorts of things, just basic skill checks and just question and answer and dialogue. So I don't want to say no mechanics. What I mean is no like mathematical style game-like mechanics. It was more the conversation. And combat was, it's definitely its own thing. In fact, your attack bonuses or your ability to hit things, I should say, your Thaco, your two hit armor class zero, derived from your class. It wasn't really related to your stats other than the occasionally, if you had a very high strength, you might get a +1 from that strength applied, and it kind of grew from there. Well, and then later in D&D, I'm really going about this in a circle, so forgive me if just sort of trust and hang in there. I'll get back to the point. Later in D&D, you know, they introduced a lot of mechanics for other things, skills, social roles, like things like intimidation and diplomacy, for instance. And with third edition forward, they kind of streamlined all those into the same mechanics. So you roll a d20 versus a difficulty number. And in combat, the difficulty number is an armor class, but it's still just a difficulty number. And saves are d20 versus a difficulty number, you know, which is the DC of the save. And so it's very of a piece, if you will. So there's no reason to think that simple systems aren't of a piece as well. If you have a die roll to resolve something that you attempt, you do the same thing. You know, trying to hit something with a sword, trying to hit an enemy with a sword is just an attempt of a sorts. So you stick with the same die mechanic in Lasers and Feelings. That's briefly for those of you who don't know, it's a game by... Oh, his name always drops out of the side of my head whenever I go to talk about him. John, he wrote Blades in the Dark. He wrote Ghost Echo. He wrote Lasers and Feelings. He wrote Mustang. He wrote Harper, John Harper. I knew I'd get there. So John Harper wrote Lasers and Feelings, a very simple game. You always get one D6 to roll to see how things go. And you get another D6 to roll if you are an expert at a subject, at the thing you're attempting. And you get another D6 if you're prepared. So I might be trying to pilot a scout ship out of orbit and land it, even though a stabilizer is broken, let's say. And I get a D6 to just try that, regardless of who I am. If I've got two hands that can interface with the controls of the cockpit, I can give it a shot. If I am a pilot, I'm an expert at this. So I get another die to roll. And if I have landed things like this before in the fiction, or I'm trying to think of other ways I might be prepared for this. How do you prepare for being out of control in a well, let's just say that I've landed, this has happened to me before, and I've landed ships before from orbit that were damaged, and so I'm prepared for this. I've had experience in it. That would get three dice to roll. And so you roll those and you're looking for successes. And if I remember correctly, it's been a little while, but you know, a four plus is a success. A high roll is a success. And one success gives you the sort of most basic success, often fleeting or with a downside. And the next one gives you a clear success. And three successes means you do it and you get extras. So maybe I somehow bring the stabilizer back online before I even have to land and can get the ship back into orbit. Or maybe I land it so smoothly that it doesn't jostle any of the ship's contents and nobody takes damage, you know, if I get three successes. But if I get one success, it's going to be a hard landing, right? We might eat a lot of dirt. The ship may be a complete scrap heap once we get down. And we may land in a place we didn't intend to land, like right in the middle of an ocean. But we landed. So that's just basically that's the basic resolution system of lasers and feelings. Okay, back to the point. You tried to stab a goblin. You roll your dice just like normal, or whatever resolution system you're using in lasers and feelings. You know, am I a fighter? If so, I'm probably an expert at swordplay. Have I fought goblins before? If so, I'm probably prepared to fight goblins unless they ambushed me and I wasn't, you know, aware. Like maybe in the first round, I'm not prepared because I got surprised or something. But anyway, so once you've decided how many dice you roll your dice. Okay, it's what comes after that's really the question here. And I'm sorry I've taken so long to get to it. So you succeed or you fail. You know, let's say the goblin succeeds at, in this case, failure and success are kind of twined together. So if you fail, it probably means the goblin succeeded at stabbing you. But let's just say, you know, you got hurt, right? You lost the exchange. What does that mean? Well, in a purely fictional sense, you can just say, you can just describe it. You get a long cut down your leg and are bleeding profusely. You know, within seconds, the floor is slippery and it's harder to, you know, or you're losing, it's hard to maintain focus and fight while your footing is bad, or it's hard to stand on that leg. You can't put your weight on that leg. You know, that's just a descriptive thing, but you can kind of keep piling on the description until it's obvious that somebody should be out of the fight. It's a little bit like narrative encumbrance, right? Not everybody tracks encumbrance, but there's a friend of mine, Alex Schroeder, who does a podcast called Halberds and Helmets, and his encumbrance system is you start reading off your list everything that you're carrying, and if I start laughing, you're carrying too much, right? And I think that can work with damage too. After a couple of these severe things, the last thing you might inflict on somebody is for them to black out or pass out or to get knocked in the head and fall down. And then you work from there. Like, do they get taken captive? Is everybody down and the goblins go through and slit their throats and take all their stuff. And that's the end of that party, whatever it is, you know, you can just do it fictionally. But that's not satisfying to a lot of people because they want to know how close to death they are and when it's going to happen. And so the other extreme of that is having a hit points pool and just working down the numbers. And it gets so abstract that a lot of times people don't even, you know, think about how damaged they are. It's just, oh, I still got 5 points. I'm good. You know, I can run away. I can do anything with 5 hit points, right? As long as I don't lose those, I'm good. Well, that's kind of silly. And in between those two things, you could have a very simple system. And this is I've been thinking about putting out an advanced or expanded Sorcerers and Sellswords. And here's how I'd do it. I would give characters and enemies levels. Most things wouldn't have levels, you know, mooks, like basic goblins probably wouldn't have levels, but the goblin boss, the goblin king might have a couple levels. And I would just represent the levels by like stack poker chips, let's say. And think of them as stress tracks from Fate. So if I'm a level 3 character, I've got, you know, maybe you start out with two and then you get plus one per level. So at level one, I'd start out with three of these things. By level three, maybe I'd have five, let's say. And what that means is that's how many fictional conditions, serious fictional conditions I can take before I'm out of the fight. And that would allow you to kind of scale threats. So a dragon might have like 12 of these chips, right? And you've got to basically do serious wounds to it 12 times to get it out of the fight. And if you really think that like somebody rolled, you know, three successes with a fireball spell or something like that, and you want to do it a lot of damage, you take, you know, you take two chips or three chips off. That's, I think, a nice, fast, easy way to do damage, and even represent it on the table so you can kind of see how big somebody's stack is, you know, how seriously they should take it, or how close to death it is before. And it also works then for, like, if you wanted to do some dual damage, you could get something down to like one chip and then, you know, do you yield? Like, do you want me to spare your life before I put this final thrust into your heart or not? So it's not about, you know, or you could just be working on, you say, I'm not actually damaging, you know, I'm just trying to hit it to knock it out. And if you get the damage, you take away the chip and it's knocked out, it's not actually dead. So there's ways you can sort of work back and forth between the narrative effects of combat and the mechanical effects without getting into the nitty gritty of numbers. Now, chips, numbers, they're really the same thing, aren't they? I mean, that's kind of a macro version of hit points, but somehow not actually having them be math, I think, frees you up a little bit to be more narrative. So that's how I would handle it. I hope I answered your question, Dennis. If I didn't, feel free to call back in. I enjoyed hearing from you so much. It's really cool to hear somebody from another country listening to my podcast. Congratulations on getting through my shattered form of speaking and my Midwestern accent and nasality. Good for you. I love that you've discovered it after all this time. And so cool to have a listener from another place that I can relate to. So keep calling in if you like, and hope you enjoy the show. All right, everybody. I think that's it for today. I certainly have talked long enough and probably given you plenty to think about. I still have more to think about myself from digesting all of this and what it means. So have a great weekend, and I will talk to you all again soon.